Hello and welcome to 120 Outdoors, where the conservation-minded outdoors men and women explore all things hunting and fishing in the lands and waters that make it all happen.
Join Chris DePaula and me, Don Klaus, as we discuss the outdoor world in our 120. But wherever you are, we think you just may find this fits your 120 too.
Hi, folks. Welcome to 120 Outdoors. My name is Chris DePaula, and I'm here with my co-host, Don Klaus, and we have a great show lined up for you today. But before we start the show here, I want to thank all of our listeners again. We picked up quite a few listeners here the past several months, whether you're listening on Spotify, Apple, or any of the other platforms. We appreciate your time. We know there's tons of podcasts out there, and everybody's busy, so we thanks again for that. The other thing is you could follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and X. We have all that out there for you, too, if you want to follow our podcast on there. And let me introduce our guest today. We're going to talk a little bit about one of my favorite subjects, the Great Lakes smallmouth. And I couldn't find anybody better than this guy here. I've fished with him several times over the past few years, and it's Hans Mann. He's the owner-operator of Buffalo Harbor Outfitters. And I know, Hans, one of your favorite things to do is fish for smallmouth on Lake Erie.
Oh, yeah.
And welcome to the show. Yeah, welcome to the show, my friend.
Yes, welcome, Hans.
Good to be here. Good to be here.
Well, Hans, we want to talk smallmouth, absolutely. But as Chris mentioned, we know Lake Erie is your playground, the Great Lakes, Lake Erie in particular, and then even getting a little narrower in the Buffalo area.
Sure.
So I guess before we start talking smallmouth, how about talking about the waters you got there? I know. Well, everybody knows that Lake Erie's had a change that has gone on for many decades, and you've gotten to see a good chunk of that. And also in your neck of the woods there's been a change where industrial domination to transition away from that. So I guess before we start talking about the fish, let's talk about the water you play in there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in reality, Lake Erie, you know, especially around the cities, whether it be Buffalo or Cleveland or whatever, is, you know, we're the culprits of a lot of the big, you know, pollution problems in Lake Erie. I mean, they have cleaned up their act and it has become a true success story on Lake Erie. I mean, the water quality at this point is, you know, better than it's been in, you know, recorded history. And, you know, it only is getting better. I mean, back, even in the 90s, you know, you had so many people focused on, you know, stopping, you know, industries from dumping into Lake Erie and things like that. And now it's come, you know, full circle to the point where, I mean, you know, you got like, say, the Buffalo River right up in the heart of Buffalo. I mean, that used to be just industrial, you know, steel mills and grain elevators and other industries and things like that. And of course, those places, especially back in the day, all used to make some pretty nasty byproducts that would just get, you know, run out of pipe into the Buffalo River and then into Lake Erie, you know? And I mean, now you have a bunch of, you know, places that rent out kayaks or pedal boats or whatever all these different things are. And I mean, if someone had a pipe of ooze coming out of it, you know, someone's going to take a video and put it on Facebook and you're going to be in trouble, you know. So I think that has become a, you know, I mean, in I think that really stopped a lot of things and people got their act together in a big way. Not that there's still not things that can be done, but I mean, the water quality has gotten so much better, and that is proven by, I mean, the ability of fish to spawn and the things that have been happening lake-wide from, you know, from Toledo to Buffalo. I mean, the walleye are spawning at having very successful spawns. We have some of the best walleye fishing that we've had. The smallmouth fishing is phenomenal across the whole lake. I mean, our end of the lake is very, very good for that. And, you know, there's also a bunch of people, you know, repairing habitat and building new habitat and making areas that are, set aside for these fish to spawn, and things like that. So, I mean, Lake Erie is a wonderful fishery, and it's only getting better. And I mean, as long as everyone keeps being a good steward of the water, it should stay top notch for a long time.
I agree, Hans. And you know, to add to that, here on the Ohio side, Dawn and I were just talking about this the other day, and I don't know if you were aware of this or not, but the first time ever in Ohio they had documented lake trout spawning take place this past fall.
Wow.
Yeah, they actually found some juvenile lake trout. And then the other thing is the Cuyahoga River is so clean now that they're actually going to stock the Cuyahoga River with steelhead for the first time ever this spring.
That
just tells you everything you just talked about, how the Great Lakes have been cleaning themselves. The Great Lakes Protection Act was put into place.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is something where it even goes up to, there's even people eating the fish. I mean, I do these charters all the time. There's a lot of people that know that that it's fine. And basically, we eat those walleye a lot. I mean, I know some people that do testing on the actual fish to find out the contaminants. You know what I mean? And the contaminants of these walleye that we're all eating are basically negligible. I mean, it's not yet. You know, in New York State, they still tell you you can only eat, one meal per week. And then, of course, people's reaction is, well, if I can only eat one meal per week, why would I eat it at all?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's really kind of a it's really kind of a sham because, the fish that they sell at the fish market that comes from the Atlantic Ocean has a heck of a lot more bad stuff in it than the fish do from Lake Erie.
Yeah, that's probably
so
true.
It is true.
Yeah.
And it's something where, they're just doing, I don't really know why, whether it's just to have people not want to keep them or whatever. I mean, we do need to make sure that people aren't over harvesting and things like that.
Right, but, right.
You know, there's things that, that people don't realize about how much better it's gotten. And that's really the main thing. I mean, it's not, if you're out there every day and you see what kind of life exists out on that lake, I mean, it is a, you said the lake trout. I mean, people don't realize there's an incredible lake trout fishery on Lake Erie.
Yeah.
You know, it's not as big as say Lake Ontario or Lake Superior or something like that. But like there's areas where you can catch really nice lake trout on that lake.
Oh yeah.
And they are, big and fat and awesome fish, and I mean, they, that seems to be good, if not better than it was. And I mean, there's, like we were talking about earlier, I mean, the bass fishing changes, but the bass fishing is still incredible, from end to end on that lake. And, I see a lot more of the changes as just cyclical changes in the, the population size, where you go from, you have a small population of huge fish, which then that lends to itself slowly turning into a bunch of small fish, and then that slowly cycles back into being a bunch of big fish. And it just over the, over tens or decades or whatever, I mean, that will just morph back and forth, and, I think that's pretty natural. I don't think it has much to do with the water quality, but I mean, everything matters. That's the other thing, is you try and break this stuff down. I mean, everything has a percentage of pull on how these fish end up, but I mean, right now, it's a wonderful place to catch bass, that's for sure.
Well, I could testify to that. I my arms are tired when I'm fishing with you. the days we've been out, it's crazy. Why don't you take us through some of the, I know you and I have talked about this while we're on the boat fishing, the seasonal cycle of the Great Lakes smallmouth. What exactly, I know the smallmouth start moving in early spring, and how long do they stay in the shoreline area? I mean, could kind of take us through the whole year. If someone was chasing smallmouth up there,
sure.
What can they expect?
Well, I mean, in the, the Lake Erie is a huge lake, I mean, it's a, I believe 6.4 million acre lake, So it's just the size of it is just so massive that, I mean, these fish have the ability to go wherever they want, and that is the one thing that changes the fishery, is that you're not always looking for the same kind of structure that you would be on a smaller lake. You know what I mean? So pre-spawn, which is, you know, is, I mean, basically April here, where the water's still cold. A lot of years we've still had ice on the Buffalo end of the lake in April. Not this year, but that's when those temperatures just break and start heading up a little bit. And I mean, those fish will start becoming pre-spawn, which to me is where they come on to, they come out of the depths and they go into the, you know, 35 or, you know, 20 to 35 feet of water, and they'll be hooked to, you know, the silt to rubble line, where it changes from silt to rock.
Yeah, the break line.
Yeah, so that's probably the first place where they will, where they will come in to start feeding heavily, you know, pre-spawn. Then, I mean, those same pre-spawn fish will creep into the first ledge, you know, and, 20 to 25 to 30 feet of water, you know, depending on the situation. But so, yeah, so early on, I mean, that's when I like fishing for them the most, is pre-spawn. For one, they're big. For two, I mean, people say, well, you shouldn't be messing with them when they're full of eggs like that. Well, the water's cold. You know what I mean? You're catching them in, I mean, they don't fight as hard as they do in the midsummer. You know, so I mean, to tell you the truth, you have your shot at your biggest bass at that point. Not that they still don't fight good, but I mean, they, you know, they end up being, you know, I love fishing for them then, because I feel like you're doing very little harm to them.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They're very easy to catch and release without any fish dying or anything like that. I mean, it's a very nice time to go, not to mention they're gigantic.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, that's when everything really starts, usually is April. And then all of May, you can still find pre-spawn fish. I mean, I think the biggest misconception that people have when I'm talking bass with them is, or any kind of fish for that matter, is they feel like there's a marked moment when all the fish go into a place and spawn, and then a marked moment when they all come out. When in a situation like Lake Erie, you have a bajillion smallmouth, and that spawn is probably drawn out over, you know, a month and a half, you know what I mean? Where the first push of fish will come in. And I mean, there could be fish. I mean, you can see a fish every once in a while in there when the water's way too cold and they shouldn't be in there, but there's already fish that have made it in and are up on beds, you know? And then you don't notice them though, until there's tons of fish up on beds. You know what I mean?
Right,
and then you see them up there, but you know, the spawn is spread out. So, I mean, as you at the end of this, you know, you'll have the spawn happen and those fish leave and go back out, and you'll have other fish just coming into spawn. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
it's like different waves.
Of course.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And there's different, you know, you know, the fish just have different personalities, and there's different, you know, they're coming and going. And that's why you constantly need to be fishing, you know what I mean, in order to really stay on them, is because there's going to be movements and things throughout that little, that are, you know, that, you know, one day might be really good because a group of them just moved back out and they're ready to eat, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
or
yeah.
A group is, or they're still pre-spawners, you know, you every once in a while, like you're catching a bunch of dark fish and that are colored up and they've been up eating for a while and blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden you catch this big old cream colored, you know, one out in 30 feet of water. And you're like, look at this. This thing hasn't even spawned yet.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like this one just came in, you know, and maybe they're just late to the game, or maybe, you know, who knows what happened. But that's the big thing, is they kind of, they're staggered throughout, you know, May and even into June, you know, there's,
some,
a lot of that spawning at the end of May and June. Yeah.
You know, one,
it seems.
Yeah. One thing before you go any further with the seasonal patterns, yeah, here, I want to ask you too, because I know you and I have fished together quite a bit in April, early May. There is that catch and release season on the Great Lakes in New York. And most states have, I know Ohio and Pennsylvania had the same thing. So you're allowed to fish for the bass.
Yes.
But you cannot, and it has to be artificial bait, correct? And
artificial bait.
All catch and release, right?
That is correct. Okay. And I mean, that is a, I think it's a very nice way to do it. I mean, the bass are super fun to catch. Mm-hmm. And I mean, most people are not looking to eat bass. I mean, I have not kept a bass since I was a little boy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, and I don't have any problem with somebody that just recreational fish is eating a smallmouth here and there. But I mean, as a guide, I don't keep bass.
Right.
You know, mean, I also do perch trips. I do walleye trips. If you want to eat, let's go get those.
That's right. That's right.
I think I'd take the walleye.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, Hans, one of my questions, and I know we used to fish for smallmouths quite a bit out of Conneaut, Ohio, after the spawn, you know, in June, starting in June and in July, it seemed like there were resident fish stayed there in the harbor, the Conneaut Harbor, or very close to it. Is that what you're noticing on your end of the lake, too? I mean, are there some resident fish that stay there all year?
Yeah, it kind of feels to me like it's immature fish.
Okay.
Or really old ones that are like unhealthy for some reason, you know?
Okay.
I feel like they are, and that may be right. It's just what I see. Like you, if you catch a big smallie in the harbor in the summertime, like it's usually like a beat up old warhorse, you know what I mean?
Okay.
Whereas, and there's usually a bunch of smaller fish.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, most of the big healthy bass are moving out to deeper waters and just getting into those, you know, you'll catch fish in the summer in 40 feet of water, you know, it's not.
Wow.
I mean, they're out there, you know, on the sand flats or, you know, eating whatever they can, you know, so I mean, I'll tell you, I'll be completely honest with you too. Like, I mean, I really focus on them in the spring and I do a bunch of for them in the fall. I mean, I'll do a bass trip whenever anybody wants to. The thing is I focus on it a lot more. Like my April and May is almost all smallmouth.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, you were talking about that catch and release season where it just goes all year. I mean, that is, and it's artificial only, which I mean, when I first started guiding, I did some drifting with you know, golden shiners or emerald shiners or whatever, which I did. I really don't do bait for bass anymore. I mean, I do all artificials.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I mean, we smash them, whether it's little kids or whatever. I mean, I have no problem getting a 8-year-old to catch fish on tubes or paddle tails or whatever, you know?
Yep.
So it's a very nice thing that we're able to target those fish all year long. It's just, you know, we just got to take care of them.
So in the summer they'll slide out to that deeper water. And I know that would be hard to really concentrate on those fish out way out deep there, but when did they start moving back? Do they move back in shallow in the September when the water starts to cool?
Yeah.
Oh, they do.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, and my fall is all full of muskies and perch and, you know, all sorts of things. So I actually get to bass fish less than I want to, but I mean, there's great crankbait bites where you can get up on the reefs and catch those fish, you know, in different ways than, you know, you do pre-spawn, you know? So yeah, they move back up and they, you know, in the fall, they start eating heavily because they know that frigid cold water's coming and it's going to make it, you know, hard for them to feed probably. So they, I mean, you catch those smallmouth, everything that you're doing out there, which kind of shows how much of them are around. I mean, you catch smallmouth super deep when you're perch fishing sometimes, you know what I mean? Like you'll catch a nearly white smallmouth that's just like down there in the abyss, just pecking away at stuff. And then you'll catch one, you know, suspended out in 90 feet of water, 40 feet down, trolling for Walters.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
And all of a sudden a rod goes off and you're like, this feels weird. And it ends up being a 5-pound smallmouth, you know, or like, you know, they kind of, I mean, to a point, you got ones all over the place, but they are very patternable. I mean, you'll find the big groups of them in one spot, but
I remember when we were out last year, Hans, that we tried walleye that one morning, and we were trolling along there. All of a sudden, the reels go off. It's all smallmouth. And then you're like, what the hell? So we ended up moving. We had to go further out. Or actually, we went closer in, and we got into some walleye. But exactly what you said, they seem to school up in areas. And every rod, not every rod, but I think three or four of the rods went off, and they were all smallmouths.
Right. So we went through we went over a little den of toads there that we were looking for the walleyes. But they're all over the place. And I mean, the thing is I do tend to, I mean, just as a disclaimer, I don't fish for them shallow. Like every once in a while I'll go in and throw jerk baits like along the weed beds up in there. But I mean, in essence, you're fishing for spawning fish at that point, you know? And I mean,
that's true.
Especially along the shoreline of Buffalo, you have a ton of people fishing offshore. That, I mean, those fish are right there within 10 feet of the breakwall, and anything that you plop in that nest, they're going to bite.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you have a lot of pressure on them. You know what I mean? And it's something where, as a guide, at any given moment, and that's one of the reasons why the bass fishing is so great pre-spawn, is because they're all out there, you know, or the big, gross chunk of them is out there. There are always fish on that break. You know, that 18 to 25 feet. I mean, there's always going to be fish out there no matter when you're fishing. It's just to varying degrees.
Yeah.
You know, so I like to target those fish because I just feel like I don't want to mess with them when they're spawning. So, and as a guide, somebody who's fishing a lot, you know, I mean, if I'm out there fishing every day, it's different than somebody going out there, you know, here and there and catching a couple bass. I mean, for me, if I was to be, you know, throwing stuff shallow all day long, I'd be really beating on them.
Yeah, you're swinging a bigger hammer.
Right. Yeah. So I just choose to focus on those deeper fish.
Yeah. Well, Hans, you talked previously about the changes that have occurred over the lake. And since we're talking about smallmouth, we can't talk about changes without talking about the round goby. And I know that's had some impact over the years, and we know smallmouth love them. So why don't you take us through, you know, your observations over the years on round gobies and how they fit the picture.
Yeah, so I mean, the goby obviously has now become one of the main food sources for all the fish. I mean, the perch are eating them, the walleye are eating them, I mean, the muskie are eating them, and the bass, of course, they're right in their wheelhouse. You know, I mean, they're basically like a fish that is a crustacean. You know what I mean? It's like you took a bait fish and mixed it with a crayfish, and now you have this little thing that's just scuttling through the rocks. You know what I mean? It's like this morphed little frog, crayfish, fish, little weird soft thing that is just like a McNugget for them. You know what I mean? So there's no spines on them or anything. They're just like the softest, most glorious thing for them to eat. So, I mean, obviously, they're getting chowed down on by everything that swims out there. I mean, I can remember pre-goby, I mean, that it was, you know, it's still a very similar bite. However, I mean, that there's just so many more now that, you know, that it's, I mean, they're all in the same areas, which is kind of why they kind of fit the ecosystem very well, even though, you know, you got people that are upset that they're here. I mean, they didn't stick like they did because they didn't make sense. I mean, they make very good sense for how they live and what they do in that lake. So for better or worse, they're here. And I mean, they've become a main staple. I mean, I remember we caught the first one probably in like 1992 or 1993. And we didn't know what the heck that thing was. And we, you know, put it in a sandwich bag and froze it and took it into the DEC and like made this big thing. And they're like, that's a round goby. Make sure you kill all those so they don't take over. And, you know, they took over all right. I mean, now there's literal carpets of them out there.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Like a little prehistoric animal, those things. They look so weird.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean.
How big do they get, Hans? I mean, are they 3 or 4 inches long, or do they get bigger than that?
Oh no. We've seen some lonkers. They'll get up to like 7 inches long. You know, and they turn real dark. I mean, that's one of the big things that goes along with that whole idea of the big black tubes for muskie in the upper river. you know, is that there's big gobies down there that, I mean, the bigger they get, the darker they get. And they're just scuttling along the bottom. And they, the big thing that sets the gobies apart from other kinds of fishes, they have no air, they have no bladder, no air bladder, you know, so they sink. So when they, the only way that they come off the bottom is by propelling themselves off the bottom. When they stop swimming, they float back down, you know. And if you think about it, that's very similar to a tube. You know, whether you're smallmouth fishing or you're, you know, whether you're smallmouth fishing or you're musky fishing, that's what they, you know, it's very, you know, it crosses over very easily to what those, you know, some kind of jig looks like.
Yeah, that's exactly what a tube looks like.
Yeah, that's the behavior.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Exactly. And that's something where these, you know, any of these little paddle tail baits or anything. I mean, that's why everyone runs that pumpkin color on Lake Erie. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's why the tubes work so good. I mean, the tube that has always been thought of as mimicking a crayfish shooting along, and it does a great job of that. It also very well mimics a goby, you know, so you're almost getting a two for one.
You know?
You throw a, you know, a pumpkin color tube down there. I mean, you know, everybody's got their new things. And I mean, I got a full array of drop shot stuff and, you know, a bunch of, you know, all different kinds of stuff. But, you know, the tube is still my number one producer out there for smallies.
I know that, you know? We're together. That's basically all of us are using the tubes.
Yeah.
So what?
Yeah.
Take us through that now, Hans. Why? What are some of your favorite techniques? I know being with you, the tube is definitely the go-to. But I know we've had success on paddle tails too. How about?
Absolutely.
Take us through some of that. Your choices there.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it comes down to, you know, we got a bunch of different baits that I know they really like to bite on any given day. Now, of course, there's small, you know, differences in, you know, color or weight or whatever that change the, you know, the how quickly they're biting that day, you know, and how fast of action you have. With that being said, it's usually just you have the choice of a couple different variations and that's the one for the day. I choose my baits more on fit and function, you know, than on the actual color and the shape. I really like the tubes because I tend to fish a lot of rocks, whereas a lot of the other guys, they really stay away from the real rubbly areas because they don't want to get snagged, you know. So a lot of the other guides, a lot of other people, like, they don't want to fish the craggly, nasty rock that I fish because they lose a lot of baits. So, I mean, one of the big things about the tube is that I pair that up with a football head. And those football heads, you know how they're shaped like a football, and it makes that head broaden out. And along with the head getting broadened out and with the body of the tube making it even wider, you have like this big fat-headed tube that looks very similar to a goby, that looks very similar to a crayfish. However, that broadened head really keeps it from slipping into cracks and crevices and things like that. Whereas a paddle tail, if you're using a quarter ounce jig or a 3/8 ounce jig, like those will, they just get snagged more, you know?
Yep.
And because of the lack of the body, over the jig head, they also, the tube sinks a little slower. So it kind of glides along the bottom and refuses to get caught in snags as much. And, you know, when there's a ton of guys out fishing the sand flats, I can still get fish off of the rock piles because no one's really fishing it. And, you know, there's still a ton of good fish there.
There is.
So, I mean, I do a ton of, you know, I love my you know, little spinning rods, you know, 6.5 to 7.5 foot spinning rods. I love medium light tackle, medium light, you know, and, you know, smaller spinning reels with, you know, 10 pound super line. I got my different brands that I like, but I don't think it's that important. You want a low diameter, very small, you know, something that is super sensitive that gets down there quick, along with, I usually run 8 pound fluorocarbon. So I'll run 6 pound 6-pound leaders that are, or 8-pound leaders that are 6 feet long. And basically, you know, as they break off, we retie them until they get down to like 3 feet long, and then we'll change them, you know?
Yeah. Hey, so, back to those jigs, Hans, what size are we using those football jigs? I know you've mentioned this to me before. I don't, is that quarter ounce we're using, or are they heavier than that?
Use quarter ounce a lot.
A quarter. Okay.
Yeah. Quarter ounce is what I use, primarily. But they are, you know, as it gets deeper, if you're fishing in, you know, depending on the wind and stuff, I do 3/8 a lot. I mean, every once in a while we'll run a 1/2 ounce when we're out really deep. And you know, it becomes a, you know, just a thing of touch and feel. I mean, it has a lot to do with the wind direction, which way the current's going, and how fast you're moving. And that ends up being the thing that makes the choice. But I mean, for a huge amount of time during the pre-spawn time there, I will have a bunch of, you know, quarter ounce jigs on my, my rods ready to go. Yeah. And then we switch if we need to.
You know, the thing I noticed fishing with you so much over the past few years, you like to keep everything just simple. And I think as anglers, we overcomplicate everything. But I noticed fishing with guides like yourself or guys that have spent a bunch of time on the water, over time you learn to just simplify things. Is that true?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And you know, I suggest that to everybody. You know, I mean, and it's hard when you're in the discovery phase of fishing where you're trying to figure out what you think. I mean, everybody thinks there's always, you know, the grass is greener on the other side. There's always a better lure. There's always a better, you know, you come to a point where you're like, this is what I'm working with. And, you know, when people are paying you to take them out and get their fit, like, I mean, real quickly, you realize what is your bread and butter. You know what I mean? And real quickly, you realize what is the things that are putting fish in your boat each day. And, you know, at that point, you know, from a guide's perspective, I go through a lot of tubes. I go through a lot of paddle tails. I go through, you know, a couple different, you know, I use some blade baits at certain times. I use, you know, things like that. But you get focused in on which colors constantly keep doing it, and you end up buying them in huge bulk amounts, you know. And then you have that, and you know that this is what's going to get bit. And, like, I mean, most days I'll start people out with the same size jig head and, you know, have a couple different shades of tube or colors out there, you know, a couple different shades of, you know, greens or blacks or tan or whatever, and see which one they're really hammering that day, and then slowly switch people over, you know.
Yeah.
And unless if it's really hot, I mean, but yeah, I mean, once I have those rods set up and they're ready to go, I mean, we, you know, it also is you get a huge body of evidence by being able to watch, you know, sit there and watch people catch fish every day. And, you know, you get a real good look at the big picture, you know, on overall what is your true killer. You know what I mean? Like, you get to see what is the true bait that really
Absolutely.
Does well, because that just performs every single day. And, you know, you got three people on board. And, I mean, that's the other thing to keep it simple. You got three people on board nearly every day that may or may not be know what they're doing, or some people do, some people don't. And, like, you got to be able to manage that whole thing. So keeping it simple is, you know, and I mean, for people that are new, that will help them too. You know, I mean, keep it simple. Get something that, you know, that other guys are catching fish on, and just commit to it, you know?
Yeah. Now, you touched on on the rod that you use, Hans, but if you were telling somebody who's coming up to fish with you, bring this one rod, what would that, take us through exactly what that would look like.
All right. Well, I really like I personally like a 7 to 7.5 foot rod with, I like it to have a fast action where, you know, you still have that stiffness in the butt where you can feel where it telegraphs feeling very well, because you know, especially pre-spawn, those, I mean, Chris, you've felt it. I mean, those fish sometimes just barely inhale it, and you just feel, you know, they slurp it up, and you just barely feel some ooey gooey thing, and you know, you don't even feel a thump or anything like that. You just feel a difference in the way that your line is presenting, and you know it's a fish. You know, so you want to have a sensitive rod. Where I mean, and if you get too noodly, then you're losing that throughout the length of the rod. So I mean, I like that rod to be pretty stiff in the bottom part of it, you know, and then have a faster action. But I want a full bend, you know, because those fish fight hard, and you know it. You know, you're dealing with 8 or 6 pound line, which often is frayed up, so it's not 8 or 6 pound line. You know, so you need to fight those fish, you know, and you need to have some drag slipping here and there. You know what I mean? And you have to do that. So, I mean, I just love a nice thin rod. I mean, right now working with Ted Pappas there. I mean, he is Bad Ted.
Yeah.
Bad Ted is designing some rods for me right now. So, you know, it's going to be I mean, I already use my personal rods. I use rods that he custom made for me. And I mean, that's why, you know, I have a hard time actually explaining exactly what, because I'm not a rod builder. So I have a hard time explaining exactly what I'm looking for. I mean, Don, I know that you make rods, so you're probably looking for a more thorough answer here. However, you know, I know it when I feel it, you know. And I mean, at this point, we've probably gone through 3 or 4 different blanks, and I mean, he's got a couple right now that are just perfect. So I'm really looking forward to that, because we're going to kind of make a little, you know, run of Carver rods, you know?
Yeah, that's a great idea.
So
I know that rod I have that I really enjoy using up there is 7, I think it's 7'2".
Yes.
And that rod is and you're right, those the hits up there some days, it's just a little thud. That's all it is. You can barely feel it. And then all of a sudden you got a 4 pound smallmouth on, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's where, you know, the cool thing about the smallmouth is that, you know, they're very, it's truly finesse fishing. You know what I mean? Like, it's truly finesse fishing. And I mean, that makes it so fun though, when then you rear back and you just feel that solid weight, you know what I mean? And then you feel it head shaking down there. And I mean, you need good tackle to do it at a high level, you know, because they, you know, once you get that, you know, the line matches the reel and the reel matches the rod and the rod matches the fish. And next thing you know, you put a whole bunch of beautiful smallies in the boat.
That's the truth.
I think most people would agree with exactly what you said, Hans. You know it when you feel it, you know, when it's in your hand and it's right. That's when you know. You might not know the technical details, but you just know.
Yeah, I mean, I've said what I said to you over and over again, whether it's someone that has a bunch of different rods that they're selling that are just, and, you know, everybody is comparing the rod to something else. So it's very hard to, you know, talk to just any other given fisherman about how exactly the rod performs. You know what I mean? But that's it. You got to get it in your hand and you got to use it for a day, and you know, and you got to use it on a day where you're catching a bunch of fish, you know what I mean? And then you really get it keyed in, and that's what I'm looking to do.
Very good.
Yeah. Hey, Hans, that's a lot of our listeners want to get out there and try for smallmouth, too. How about the wind and the weather up there? I know last year when we were together, we had waves going over the break wall and it was snowing.
Right.
And we were safe in the harbor there catching smallmouth, which is still hard to believe, as bad as that weather was. But what do you, as far as what would you recommend the average angler to look at? Obviously, the weather forecast. The wind direction.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, how about the wind direction? Because I know where that area sits up there in that east corner of Lake Erie, that southwest wind is the one that brings all the heavy winds, correct?
Yeah. So west is the worst.
West is the worst. But, okay. I
mean, yeah. And well, southwest, you know how Lake Erie is situated. If it's like west southwest, that's probably the worst, because it's coming literally up the entire body of the lake. And that's how you end up with, you know, 20 footers coming into Buffalo, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's where, Yeah, the biggest thing that I would say is that you have to be, you know, people are always just looking for light winds. The thing is they miss out on days that are good where the wind is coming offshore wherever they're fishing. I mean, that's what you need to look for is whatever. I mean, most of the smallmouth action is inshore. You know, you're near the shoreline. So if you have wind coming off of that shore, it's going to be calm there because there's not enough fetch to build waves. You know, so if you have a south wind on Lake Erie, pretty much the entire south shore of Erie will be very easy to fish. You know what I mean? Yep. However, on the Canadian side, they're getting bashed with, you know, 2-3 footers over there, you know, which would not be comfortable to fish in.
No.
You know what I mean?
No.
So you have, that's where you need to look at where, you know, for me, I mean, if there's a north wind, I'm going to go fish up by the Niagara up towards, you know, you can stay in America, but you can see Canada right there. You know what I mean? So it's still in New York waters, but like I'll go tuck up against that because you're getting relief from that Canadian shore.
Right.
But you're still in New York waters.
I,
you know what I mean?
You.
So,
yeah.
So I'll move around depending on where, you know, the offshore winds are. And I mean, that's really all that you're looking. I mean, all day, that's all I do is I look at all my wind apps. You know what I mean? My several wind apps that I have, and you look and you just try to, you know, put them all together in your brain and figure out what the winds are going to be like. And then you choose where you're going to go, or you say, we can't go today. You know what I mean? And that's the problem with Lake Erie is that there's times where you're just not going,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And now, I mean, during certain times of the year, like free spawn, you can still get at them inside the walls of the harbor, which is really nice.
Yep.
You know, and that's another reason why I like to fish for them at that time of the year is because we can still have really good action and, you know, fish the tips of those walls, which is, you know, a great place to fish.
Yeah. Well, I've been there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big water.
And that's something where it's great. However, you know, when it's real, you know, if it's real windy on a Saturday, you're not going to be the only one there doing it.
That's true.
There's going to be a lot of people fishing those spots, and that's where it kind of gets annoying too. But, you know, it's, you know, you can still go get fish, you know.
Yeah.
So that's where you know, if you're going to come out with a small boat, I mean, and you want to try and get out each day, I mean, I mean, the Buffalo Harbor is a good place to come just because you do gain protection from those walls and you can at least fish.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, what really stinks is you come up and, you know, you come from far away and you got a hotel and blah, 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 and you bring your boat up. And then for 3 days, you can't get out on the lake.
Yeah.
Which happens on a regular basis. So, you know, that's something where you got to definitely pay attention to that weather for the reason of you want to fish, but secondly, for the reason of you want to live, because that that lake will crush you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Big so, water tends to let you know who's boss from time to time.
Yes, yes. You need to have, you know, trustworthy equipment and, you know, motors and things. And, you know, I do a lot of towing, people.
You know, that's your public service.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah,
paying your dues.
One of those things. Someone's waving at you, and they're broke down.
Yeah,
as much as I'm like, I'm in the middle of a trip. You can't leave them there.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah. Can't hand them a sandwich and say I'll be back in an hour.
Yeah, it's kind of the rules.
Right.
Yep.
Right. Right.
Now, Hans, we know those smallmouth love the gobies, and we know they can just chow down and put some pounds on. How big have you put a smallmouth in the boat?
The biggest one now here's the thing. I didn't start weighing them until 3 years ago. I have never been a weigher of fish, whether it was muskies or whatever. I've always been a just quick catch and release guy. So all the fish that I've weighed have been in the last 3 years. So we may have got, we caught some lunkers back in the day, but I don't know. I'm pretty sure the biggest one we got is 7 pounds, 8 ounces.
That's a big smallmouth.
That's football.
Yeah, that was the biggest one I've ever seen, I believe. And that was, you know, and we've got one, we got another one that was 7.4 and another one that was 7.1. And those are the three fish that I've caught over 7 pounds.
Wow.
Other than that, I mean, you know, there's, and those were, you know, just bulbously fat pre-spawn fish that, the reason they're like that is because they're full, you know, full of eggs, and they were gigantic. And, I mean, you get those, but I mean, we get, I mean, last year, I think we weighed 30 fish over 6 pounds. And I mean, I basically heavily smallmouth fish for a month and a half.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's you know, lots of 5 pounders.
Yeah.
Lots of tons of 3.5s and 4s. I mean, you've been out there, Chris.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
The 3.5 to 4 pound fish, which are no slouch in anyone's book, are so plentiful that it's ridiculous. And almost every day comes along with a, you know, a high 4 or low 5.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, and then, you know, you have day. I mean, Ted and his daughter were out and they caught 6 pounders at the same time.
I saw that picture too. That's an amazing picture too.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you know how it is.
You
get into a, you just, when it's your day, but I mean, it's an amazing smallmouth fishery for that. Just the average size is ridiculous.
It is. Yeah. You wear yourself out on those 3 and 4 pounders all day long.
Yeah. That's the thing.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I mean, you know, and, you know, here's another point to Buffalo. I mean, there's the people that know that it's a great smallmouth fishery, but I mean, you got a lot of guys that are pure bass fishermen that do that every day and they're really good guides for smallmouth. And you got, you know, you got a couple of people that recreationally do it, but they're, it's funny. You go back to the dock in Buffalo and they'll be like, you know, some guy will come up to you and be like, how many did you get today? And you'll be like 60 or something like that.
Yeah.
And they'll be like 60 yellows. Oh my God. Talking about walleye.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
It's like the walleye and the perch are king.
Yes.
around this area. You know what
yep.
I mean? So
yep.
It's like, people are like, and then I'll be like, no, I was smallmouth fishing. They're like, oh,
yeah,
you know,
like, yeah.
Oh, you're smallmouth fishing, you know, and that's, we always joke about that. A couple of my other buddies that I fish with, like you would, they always ask you, and everybody asks you how many you caught. They're always talking about walleye or perch. You know what I mean? And
yeah, then, that's true.
And they're like, why would you ever fish for smallmouth? And then I always say like, you know, if, it completely changes when you target them and when you're looking for huge ones.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it becomes so fun. I mean, who doesn't like to go out and set the hook 20 times a day?
Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean? Like, who, like, it's a whole different kind of fishing. I mean, in the Great Lakes, you know, a lot of fishing in the Great Lakes is very grindy. You know, you got to put in your time and you're looking for, you know, you got long amounts of time in between bites, but with those, you find that group. I mean, you are setting the hook on good sized fish and bending that rod and having great fights. And I mean, they're jumping and, you know,
it is.
Sometimes you catch 3 at a time, you know, where everybody's hooked up. I mean, you, it's a, you know, it's such a blast if you like purely fishing.
Yeah. We've actually done that a couple times with you, 3 fish at the same time. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a,
and whoever catches the smallest one has to buy us lunch, you know.
Yes, yes, yes. Or they just get that shameful picture where
yeah.
your buddies are both holding the lunker and they're in the middle with this like
right.
2 pounder, you know what I mean?
That's
like
right.
And then everybody makes fun of the picture from then on.
Yeah. Hey, talking about big smallmouth too, Hans. I know you and I talked about this, but there was that huge smallmouth caught in Ohio waters last year. It was 11 pounds.
Yes.
It was 11
yes.
pounds, and it's a state record. It's a certified state record, but they did a scale sample on it, and they checked that fish to see how old it was. That fish was, I think, it was 18 years old.
Wow!
Can you imagine?
Wow!
I mean, that's unbelievable. That's just a testament again back to the Great Lakes and how clean they've gotten.
Yeah, because anything, like if you're inundated in, I mean, it's just like us, like if you're living in a place where there's tons of pollution in the air, like you're not going to live as long.
Right.
You know what
right.
I mean? Like the fact that a smallmouth can live to be 18 years old means that there's number one, the water quality is pretty darn good because
yep.
it ain't, you know, it's letting it get through without getting lesions on it and everything like that, along with it's full of food. Because that thing has been eating strong for a long time
yeah.
to stay that healthy, that old.
That's
you know?
For sure.
So, pretty incredible.
Yeah, it was a cool story.
Yeah, you don't get that
yeah.
size with some malnutrition
pounds,
years.
I can't even imagine 11-pound smallmouth.
Yeah,
I don't even know what that would be.
I mean, I'd like to try it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been fishing. That's the thing is, that's the other thing, too, is, I mean, people think that, it's easy to come across, you know, all you see is pictures of 6-pounders and the occasional 7 and things like that, because of course those are the things that make it to the internet. With that being said, they're still hard to catch. You know, I mean, you know, a 7-pounder, I've only caught 3 in my whole life, you know, and there's people that have claims of many, many more than that, but I'm not sure if that's, you know, or who knows, maybe they're just, you know,
it is fishing
something out. But you know, when it all comes down to it, there's that upper echelon smallmouth, which I mean, I have not, I'm yet to see the likes of a over 8-pounder, you know what I mean? But I sure would love to someday, you know,
they're obviously out there.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it only makes sense at a place like, you know, like Lake Erie. I mean, it's just so big and it's so full of food. I mean, it's got to, it, they're out there. Yep. You know, I bet you they have completely different habits than the other ones.
Yeah,
you
know? I'll bet.
I bet you they've been out there so long. They've literally found the laziest hole in the lake where they can just sit there and eat all day long.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, if it's out of the way, that's how they get so big, is no one's ever doing it. You know, they leave them alone.
Hey, Hans, Lake Erie's been tagged the walleye capital of the world, and rightfully so. I don't know if there's any disputing that.
It's
colossal, but it just seems like smallmouth deserve a pretty high perch there, too. I don't know. Can you think? I know you're not a student of smallmouth across the country, but can you think of a place?
Well, I mean, in the Northeast, I kind of know. I would definitely put it against any of the other known places. I mean, there's a lot of people that, like the St. Lawrence has been really, you know, there's parts of Lake Ontario. I mean, even out on the Niagara Bar, like right by me here, you know, I go down there a lot to catch fish in, like when it's really windy on Erie or something. Like you can go fish in the lower Niagara River, and then sometimes you can get out onto that bar. I mean, there are giants out in Lake Ontario. You know what I mean? Like there are giant smallies on Lake Ontario. There's giant smallies in the Thousand Islands, in the St. Lawrence River. And a lot of people talk, I mean, that's where the last truly giant one came from, the Great Lakes systems in New York, was from the St. Lawrence.
Okay.
I think there was a 9-pounder caught up there or something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's giant fish that are throughout this whole system. And I mean, then it comes down to which is the better fishery overall. Like, I mean, personally, I don't know where you can go to get numbers like we get on Erie along with size. So I mean, I haven't been anywhere that's better than where I guide. And I'm not saying that to promote my guide service. I mean, it is a top-notch bass fishery.
It is.
For sure.
The only other place I would say that, and I wouldn't say it's as good as Lake Erie and what you have there, it would be Lake St. Clair. And even though it is part of the Great Lakes.
Lake St. Clair is a great smallmouth fishery, for sure.
It doesn't have the size, though, Hans, that when I've fished there before. We've got quite a few fish there, and you occasionally get a 4-pounder or so. But what you have there in eastern Lake Erie there, not only do you have numbers, you've got size, too. It's just crazy.
Yes.
It's
really
is. Those are two good things.
It is, yes. And that's where... I mean, it's a true, you know, blessing to be able to fish here as much as I do. And I mean, you're right. Right now at this moment in time, I mean, you catch a lot of fish and you catch a lot of good fish and you catch a lot of giant fish.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's, I'd put it up against anywhere right now. I mean, now with that being said, the guys, like you said, I know a little bit about a lot of things, but you know, you got guys that are in other parts of the, you know, other parts of the system up here that may know better than me. So, you know, there's guys catching monsters all around, but you know, I mean, I loosely pay attention to the bass tournaments and stuff like that. I mean, you see a guy that, you know, is driving down the entire St. Lawrence all the way out to Lake Ontario and fishing in 6-footers to win the thing, you know, and like, you got like, there's obviously, you know, little corners of the world that have incredible little, you know, incredible smallmouth bites. So, but yeah, I ain't going anywhere.
No,
you know what I mean?
I hope you're not going anywhere.
Yeah,
I don't blame you.
No. I love it.
Hey, on that note there, Hans, first of all, Don, I want to thank you for your time this morning. I know you're busy preparing for shows and everything else and catch it before the guide season. And I will see you in April, by the way.
Oh, I can't wait.
Yeah,
I can't wait.
I already have it on my calendar. I'm looking forward to it.
Yes, it'll be a blast.
If just get real quick, give us a quick summary, if an angler is coming up there to fish that area for the first time, what should they be focusing on? Is it the break lines? Is it the rocks? And tubes, I know, would be the thing to go to. But real quick, give us a little summary on that, and then we'll let you go.
Yeah, I would say that you never have a problem with parking yourself in 25 to 30 feet of water and then drifting in, or vice versa, starting, 20 feet of water and drift out. You know what I mean? Whatever the wind or the currents give you. Of course, I have my little areas where I like to do these things. However, you can do that on pretty much any drop off around the east end of the lake, and you should be able to get a smallmouth to go, if you really gotta, the wind is probably one of the biggest things to play, is which way you're going to be drifting, and you never want to be drifting the opposite way of current, and things like that. I'm probably getting too deep into it than what you were looking for already, but when it all comes down to it, you fish that 20 to 30 feet, and most often you're going to find them at certain times of the year. They'll be up on the next break, like up in, 15 or something like that. But, you can post up and cast the edges, like a lot of people are used to doing from around the country, where bass fishing is meant to be sedentary and casting at a thing. You know what I mean? Whereas this is, you do a lot better here if you drift,
Right.
You use the currents of the lake, and you use that to push you over a wide expanse of smallmouth filled area, or to cover that area.
Right.
And then as you zero in on that little part of the ridge where, one day they'll be sitting at the bottom of the drop off near that silt rock border, and you'll be catching them all down there and, 28 to 30 feet. And then you literally come out the next day where you hammered them and they're not there, but they may have moved up, and now all of a sudden they're in 24 feet, up on the edge, and there's a whole group of smallmouth up there, So you really are just kind of, you got to use your electronics. You got to use your, you just got to use what you got. And really you're just looking to mark the fish,
right.
And you mark the smallmouth themselves, and then you catch them, Yeah, it's definitely not hard to get some fish. It's harder to get 60 fish.
Yes, yes, yeah.
So, it's such a fun thing. I would recommend anybody to go out and give it a try, especially if you're new at fishing. It's a good thing to go do.
Lots of fun.
You're going to have success,
Well, we know you're in the business of fishing, Hans. So if somebody wants to catch up with you, so why don't you share with us what somebody needs to do to get a hold of you?
Well, my favorite way is old school. It's when people just call me.
That still works.
My number is 716-982-4935. So you can call me. I do have a website that you can that leads you to an email to basically email, and you'll get in contact with me that way. I have, Facebook and Instagram is what I'm most active on for social media. And that's also where, on the Hans the Carver page on Instagram or on Facebook, that's where I post most of my pictures, which I do not post pictures of every trip. However, I try to get as much up there as I can, which really just kind of, you can go back and look, and you can look through the years and see, when those pictures were posted and what time you want to come with me to do what. You know what I mean? But call me. We'll set up a trip. At this point, I think I am completely booked for April and May at this point. So we would either have to do something later in the year or book towards next year. It's getting wild. But that's a good problem.
Yes, it is. And you don't just guide for smallmouths too. Our listeners need to know you guide for walleye, perch, and then you'll do muskie too.
Absolutely. I do a lot of muskie fishing. I do October, November, December on the Buffalo Harbor. I also do, about 30 days a year up on the St. Lawrence for muskies. However, that is, I have I really can't book any more trips up there because I live here and I got a wife and kids and stuff. No, so I don't like to be away more than that.
Right, right.
I do a ton of walleye fishing. I mean, if you want to come get, you know, a cooler full of walleye in the summertime, I can do that for you. You know, perch in the spring, perch in the fall. And I mean, I even do a lot of Lake Ontario stuff. I love going out and getting those Lakers on the swim baits.
Yeah, that was fun. That was fun last year. The same tackle
as Smallies, but catching, you know, a 20-pound Laker.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty fun.
Yeah.
So all sorts of different things, but, you know, I'm a big fan. You know, in the Great Lakes, the big key is that you have to do what's good.
Yes.
Then.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like if you go to a place and you know, and this is something that obviously if people really want to do something, I'll lead them towards the best time frame to do it. But I mean, the worst thing you can do when you go, you know, when you go out fishing with a guide is be like, I want to do this and that's all I want to do. Like, you know, if something's hot, you should probably go do that because you know you're going to have a good time.
Yeah,
you
that's
know
what a good I mean? Point.
So and the Great Lakes really forces you to kind of be like that because, you know, you know, as much as you want to think you got it figured out and you're in charge, even if you fish it every day, you're not.
No, that's right.
You got to take what good Lady Erie gives you.
Yeah,
you know?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you again, Hans. I appreciate your time here. I know Don and I really enjoyed that interview.
Oh, sure.
Hey,
yeah.
Thank you so much for having me on. I love being on, and we'll I'm sure we'll see you guys soon.
Yeah,
we'll
see you this weekend.
Huge fans.
Oh, you're gonna be there.
Yeah, yeah. We'll see you this weekend.
I got a nice batch of baits this time. It's
good.
Probably my best batch I ever made. So.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that. We'll have to bring some extra money now.
No.
Yeah. All right, buddy. Well, thank you again, Hans.
We'll talk to you soon.
Yes, you take care. Thank you for your
time.
Thanks,
Hans.
See you, Don.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to 120 Outdoors and our monthly podcast. Please like, subscribe, and leave us your comments while checking out our Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to 120 Outdoors, where the conservation-minded outdoors men and women explore all things hunting and fishing in the lands and waters that make it all happen.
Join Chris DePaula and me, Don Klaus, as we discuss the outdoor world in our 120. But wherever you are, we think you just may find this fits your 120 too.
Hi, and welcome to 120 Outdoors Podcast. My name is Chris DePaula, and I'm here with my co-host, Don Klaus. And this is a bonus episode for our listeners. We had a historic event take place here in Ohio on Thursday, April 25th. But before we get into talking about that event and introducing our guest, I want to thank all of our new listeners. We know you have several podcasts to choose from out there, and we do appreciate your time. So thanks for listening. And remember, Don and I will continue to bring you new and interesting guests in the future, just like today's show. You could also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and X. And Don, do you want to go ahead and introduce first our subject and then our guest for today's episode?
Yeah, first I'll start with a little bit about our subject today. We're revisiting a body of water that we've talked about in the past, and that is the Cuyahoga River, tributary to Lake Erie. The Cuyahoga River has made some history in the past, which many people know about, and not in a positive way.
Right. Negative.
Yeah, very bad. It was horribly degraded from industrial pollution, municipal pollution, and
how could anybody forget the river that caught fire?
Well,
you know, in the 60s.
Yeah, it was very historic, and like you said, in a negative way. But we're here to talk about positive history. As Chris mentioned, you know, there's a historic event that has taken place, and that was on April 25th. And that involves the stocking of steelhead trout into the Cuyahoga River, which back in the day would never have been thought of, but it's become a reality, and it's a reality to be celebrated. And joining us today to celebrate and enlighten us is Kurt Wagner. Kurt is a fisheries manager with the Ohio Division of Natural Resources. And he's had his toes into the Cuyahoga and this whole corner of the state where the Cuyahoga flows. So, Kurt, welcome to 120 Outdoors.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, there's nobody we'd rather have to talk about this big deal. And but before we get to talking about the steelhead, if you could just give us a little enlightenment about and a brief history about the Cuyahoga to review.
Absolutely. So, yeah, it's arguably one of the most important rivers in the United States from a environmental policy standpoint, environmental history standpoint, and then of course even recreationally and commerce wise, it holds high importance. But really, we look back, you know, we all sort of talk about the river that burned. You know, we have some delicious beer named after the Burning River. And, you know, folks nationally know and have heard about the Cuyahoga and the fires. And so, yeah, as you alluded to in the intro, I mean, winding back into the 50s and 60s, the river burned often. And when we say burn, of course, water isn't burning. But, you know, it was so polluted in the industrial downtown Cleveland that, you know, floating oils and residues and all kinds of byproducts from the industry and mill there would just float on the surface. And then any kind of heat and sparks and all that aspect from the industry would just ignite the pollutants on the surface and cause a fire. And, you know, really became almost commonplace when you sort of read old documents of folks that are in downtown Cleveland sort of, oh, there it is burning again. But it happened to just sort of catch the right issue of Time magazine that had some more entertaining aspects with the Kennedy family that also had just a little blurb about the river that burns and really a little piece almost poking fun, almost satire. And that was sort of what coincided with some other environmental things of the day to sort of cause that national awareness that, like, you know, hey, we probably shouldn't be a country that has rivers that burn and be okay with that. And so, soon after that, 1972, the formation of the Clean Water Act, largely due to sort of momentum from the Cuyahoga River burning. And that generally us in sort of the environmental profession, we sort of view that Clean Water Act as sort of that first big piece of national legislation that really pushed forward what we know now with, you know, the regulations that keep us having clean air and water in the country. So there's a lot of history around it, and pop culture grabbed on it. REM has a song about the Cuyahoga. It's referenced in movies. So quite a bit of a storied history on the Cuyahoga River.
Yeah, well, we're really glad things have come a long way from then. Now, I know that you've had your work take place in Northeast Ohio for some time. In your time working Northeast Ohio and the Cuyahoga River, have you been able to see change in your time on the job there?
I have, yeah. And really, I mean, although I've been in this business here in Northeast Ohio for 16, 17 years now, it still feels like just a blink of an eye. And, you know, I'm only seeing just one little wedge of the pie of sort of the improvements that have happened over time. But yeah, I would say when I, you know, anecdotally anyways, when I first moved to Northeast Ohio, you know, I live in the greater Akron area. And so, you know, it was a place that seemed logical to me to fish. And yeah, I mean, the perception just talking to people and even in the profession was, you really got to watch the days you go fish the Cuyahoga. Like, you know, the fishing is just so-so. And then you fast forward to now, I mean, it's sort of one of the top places my son and I enjoy fishing in the summer, you know, just wet wading with shorts on for smallmouth. I mean, so even in that time frame, I've seen drastic improvements in water quality and perception of, you know, its recreational value.
Hey, Kurt, what can you kind of take us through what exactly had to take place here? I know there was dams mm-hmm. removed, and what parameters, triggers had to take place before we were allowed to stock the steelhead in the stream?
Yeah, so we didn't have very, you know, there was no real absolute value thresholds, but it's more just a general movement towards improvement. And I mean, and that rewinds back many, many years. So the Cuyahoga is one of the U.S. EPA's area of concerns, which throughout sort of the industrial rust belt area, there's, you know, these industrial rivers that are designated area of concern, and they get, special funding and special focus on sort of removing said impairments. And so for years now, a bunch of partners throughout Northeast Ohio, U.S. and Ohio EPA, the Northeast Ohio Regional Sewer District, National Park Service, Metro Parks, watershed groups, DNR, just a sort of collaboration of groups have done sort of individual, seemingly small projects here and there that then on the whole, in some over time, move the needle to actually improve water quality. So, I mean, functionally, what we're talking is cooler water, water that has sort of less sediment, water that has less sort of human waste, biological pollutions coming through, and that's largely from sewer upgrades. And then you mentioned about dam removals. That has not only helped with like allowing fish passage, but then also helped with improving the habitat, as you're not backing up water, holding sediment, warming water, deoxygenating water with these dams. You remove those, and now you have free flowing sediment transport, oxygen, cooler temperatures. You have all these things that sort of make it a more hospitable home for fish and people to use.
Yeah, that's interesting. How many dams were removed, Kurt? Do you have any idea? I mean, were there four or five dams removed? Do you know?
Five or six. So
five
you
or
know,
six.
In
this, okay.
And interestingly, a number of these really are upstream, but they have sort of that cascading effect of improved water quality as you then flow downstream towards Cleveland. So you have Kent, Monroe Falls, you have a couple in Cuyahoga Falls, and then moving further downstream, Independence area, you have the Brecksville Route 82 Dam, which was a sizable dam. It impeded most fish from moving up past it. And so those have all been removed, and very quickly we see, responses and improved habitat quality and water quality, and even documenting fish moving upstream where they haven't been before.
Yeah, that's amazing. They find a way. If there's a passage, they'll go as far as they can, obviously.
Yeah, if you let the river be a river.
Yeah.
And we are kind of in the shadows, I guess, or, the forefront of the Gorge Dam coming out in a couple years in Akron. And that's the biggest dam on the Cuyahoga. And that will sort of be that last sort of check in the box of dam removals that really improves water quality down through the sort of the lower 30 miles or so of river.
Now, let me ask you, Kurt. So really, you could fish steelhead all the way from Cuyahoga Falls, the city of Cuyahoga Falls, all the way to Lake Erie then?
Yeah, that's right. Yep. Below the Gorge Dam, which is right there at Cuyahoga Falls Akron interface. Yep.
Yeah. Holy smokes. That's amazing.
Yeah. And you kind of answered my one question, which was going to be next, which was, is anything still active? And that's a big one that's yet to fall down. And that'll.
Yeah, that is the big one. And then there's still combined stormwater overflows and sewer overflows that still need to be sort of terminated, and routing that stormwater to treatment plants. I mean, that's an ongoing infrastructure that's been happening and is still happening. But yeah, the dam is sort of that next big piece.
Yeah, that's cool. It just out of curiosity, I know you and I talked about this before. I know we're celebrating the steelhead program here in Ohio, and the huge accomplishment that's taken place. But I know you and I talked about lake sturgeon and possibly lake trout. We're using the Cuyahoga at one time. Do you have any evidence of that improving because of the water quality there?
We don't quite have evidence yet of the species you mentioned. I mean, lake trout are being reintroduced in Lake Erie, mm-hmm. Throughout Lake Erie, including Northeast Ohio. And we're sort of seeing anecdotal occurrences of lake trout coming into sort of the near shore areas, a number of places. It seems like maybe a little stronger as you get out towards, Painesville and Asheville and Conneaut.
Conneaut, yeah.
But nonetheless, you know, I'm sure as habitat improves, we'll see more lake trout. Lake Sturgeon, already having had a few years of stockings in the Maumee and looking to expand that most likely into the Cuyahoga in the next couple of years. We've already done the habitat assessment work to know that the river does seem suitable for lake sturgeon spawning. And that's one. I mean, they live so long. They take, you know, nearly a decade, even sexually mature. We won't really know the success of that for quite a while. And there's some discussions about saugerine reductions as well. So a native, a native sander species sort of akin to walleye that was also native in Lake Erie that certainly I suspect would have historically used the Cuyahoga as spawning grounds as well.
Boy, that's really exciting.
Yeah, that's a lot of interesting species there that would come into play. So back to the river again, Kurt. Does the Cuyahoga River, does it offer anything unique or really desirable as a Lake Erie tributary? I know we have a number of them up scattered along the lake there, not just in Ohio, but into PA. But the Cuyahoga, well, Chris already mentioned that there's a lot of miles there, which is a good thing. Anything to comment on there?
Yeah, so, in addition to sort of just simply standing out as sort of a crown jewel of sort of environmental history, practically speaking, from sort of a user recreational standpoint, yeah, it's that access. I believe it's, pull my numbers up here. I believe it's about 40 some miles from Cleveland Harbor to the Gorge Dam, and 31, 32 of those miles are publicly accessible sections of stream. And largely that's thanks to kind of from upstream to downstream, some Metro Parks, National Park Service, and Cleveland Metro Parks that collectively, hold that, 31, 32 odd river miles of public access. So that's the real standout. I mean, that currently where we stock steelhead, Cuyahoga aside, we have roughly about 60 river miles in total across the six tributaries of publicly accessible rivers. This would add an additional 30 just by sort of incorporating the Cuyahoga into the steelhead program. So, I mean, absolutely, that's the number one thing is just the sheer volume of public access. And it's not just public access any old place. It's public access right between Cleveland and Akron, the major population center of Northeast Ohio.
Yeah, that one hits with us. We're all about doing things close to home. Our whole 120 Outdoors is about doing things close to home, And boy, when you add that much access available to that many people, boy, they can get on it and use it handily, without great travel. It's nice to be close to home, and they haven't started giving gasoline away yet to get to these places.
Not yet. No, but yeah, the other thing, Kurt, first of all, I got to tell you, I was high-fiving Don over here talking about all that access, because I know those of us that fish steelhead know that that's one of the, and you know this, Kurt, I don't have to tell you, but maybe our listeners don't know, that's one of the concerns we have everywhere is the lack of access to a lot of the rivers. And now this is just opens up a huge door. I can just see, I could hear a lot of the steelhead guys just clapping and jumping up and down, excited about this opportunity this is going to bring for all, not only the in-state anglers, but out of state too. It's just really, an unbelievable accomplishment.
Yeah, Chris is not a big fan of having his shoulder up against somebody else's shoulder when he's fishing.
Yeah.
No.
And it is important to note that not every single river mile is created equal on the Cuyahoga.
Right.
As you look at the steelhead rivers we have, it's a little bit larger, a little bit wider. So in not every, not every place is going to be necessarily suitable to wading or to shore-based fishing. But plenty still will be. But it would also open up the opportunity for more of a kind of a float boat type fishing approach, which, is a little less common in some of our other skinnier tributaries.
Well, that's become very popular. I know guys that do it on the Grand, and I know guys do it on Conneaut when the water levels are right, you know.
Yeah, they have to be high enough.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, the other thing, too, if you could touch on it for our listeners, too, is the importance of the steelhead program to the local economy. I don't think people realize how popular this you know, steelhead fishing is here in northern Ohio. Can you kind of take our listeners through that?
Absolutely. So we always kind of talk about sort of the sad side of the story first, is that nationally and even in Ohio, recreational fishing as a whole does, you know, seem to be decreasing by about 1% participation a year. And that's just a cultural effect of sort of where we are in society. But that to say, steelhead fishing and fly fishing, which a lot of steelheaders do, is segments of the fishing, you know, industry that's actually increasing in participation and increasing in popularity. And so, yeah, when we look at, you know, the effects on the economy, we call Northeast Ohio Steelhead Alley. It already has the other six tributaries we stock. And so even, you know, before this edition of the Cuyahoga, we have, it's getting to be about a 10-year-old study or so now, but we have some work out of OSU that pointed to steelhead anglers specifically bringing over $5 million of economic input into Northeast Ohio economies just from, you know, their travels and purchases associated with steelhead fishing. If we sort of scale that up to just recreational fishing as a whole, a very recent study showed that in Ohio, it's about $5.5 billion with a B of economic inputs from recreational fishing into Ohio's economy. And a lot of that is Northern Ohio, with us having such a great array of waters that we have, plus the North Shore, Lake Erie. So, yeah, anything we do to sort of add fishing opportunities, and especially a real sort of marquee fishery like steelhead, is going to bring people in both from around the state and nationally. This year, we've been doing some on-stream angler surveys on our steelhead rivers already, and we've documented in just a few months anglers from 44 of our 88 counties traveling specifically to be fishing for steelhead. So you don't see quite that level of statewide travel for most other fishery types.
No, as I mentioned to you earlier, Kurt, too, I actually met a father and son from Washington State earlier this year. So it just goes to show you, it's not only locally, we have a lot of anglers and, you know, traveling around the state of Ohio up north to fish the steelhead, but we got anglers coming from all over the country. It's crazy.
And that story that you have is especially interesting, since they're traveling from the native area of steelhead in the, you know, the coastal Pacific Northwest. Yeah. And, you know, I also met an angler that moved from that region and was saying that, you know, the catch rates we have here in Ohio on steelhead are just not even, you know, you can't even compare. They're so good compared to what they have in the Pacific Northwest. So,
yeah, that's exactly what they were telling me too. And I had a question to them. I said, what do you mean, Washington, D.C.? And they said, no, we're from outside of Spokane, Washington. I was like, good Lord. And then they were saying the same thing, that, you know, yes, we catch steelhead and they're wild steelhead, but it's, we don't, if you get three or four a year, you're doing well. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I'm not saying you're going to catch three or four today, but there's a good possibility you can, you know, here.
Absolutely.
You know, so, but yeah, it's crazy. People traveling from all over.
Yeah. Well, hey, speaking of the numbers, you know, regarding the stocking event that took place on April 25th, Kurt, just how many steelhead got to go into the Cuyahoga?
Yeah, so on that particular day for that event, it was 10,000 steelhead. And this spring, we'll be stocking the Cuyahoga, and then much of it is happening right now this week, stocking it with 60,000 in total. So, you know, another 50,000 this week on top of last week's 10,000.
Nice.
And then how does that break down? I know there were some questions about, guys were worried about where are the fish coming from. Can you kind of give us a quick recap of where did you get those 60,000 fish from?
Yeah, absolutely. So statewide, we stock annually, and we have for two decades or more, we stocked 450,000 each year. And that number is not changing. That's our production capacity at Castalia State Fish Hatchery. That's sort of the agree upon number that we bring to the table with our Lake Erie management partners. So that number, you know, as you alluded to, that number is fixed. So those 60,000 for the Cuyahoga are coming from other places, and sort of how we, I'll get to the numbers, but sort of how we arrived at the numbers was a combination of sort of looking at the amount of access that each river has, looking at kind of the stocking rate it currently had with, you know, the number of fish per mile, let's say, just kind of considering some of the biology of the situation. And then also we engaged a number of angler representatives from the various steelheader clubs and guides, and really just tried to get some representatives that captured the flavor of steelhead anglers to sort of run some scenarios by them as well. And so to arrive at a reallocation that was both sort of biologically supported and socially acceptable among the end user group, the steelhead anglers. So the 60,000 is really a kind of a light stocking, if you will, for how big the Cuyahoga is and for how many we stock in many of the other rivers. But we also wanted to start a little light because it was new. We did have multiple stakeholders at the table along the river. So the biggest river that sort of took the hit, if you will, was the Conneaut. The Conneaut is being reduced now by 25,000. We had historically stocked it with 75,000 fish, and that number's ticking back to 50,000. And one of the, a few key aspects to that was it has sort of the lowest amount of public access river miles of any of the steelhead tributaries that we manage. And importantly, the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission also stock it annually with 75,000 steelhead. So in sum, it having gotten 150,000 for many years, it seemed like that certainly was the river to take the most from. We didn't touch the Ashabula because it was already the one we stocked the lowest at historically at 50,000. And then the remaining rivers, we took between 5,000 and 10,000 from each of those. So really it kind of smoothed out the numbers if you look across the rivers, and was a fairly light touch on any single river.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it'll make a big difference on the Conneaut, with Pennsylvania putting those fish in there too. It'll be interesting to see a couple years down the road, but I really, just for me fishing there quite a bit, I don't think it'll make that big of a deal.
Yeah.
And
I guess it's important to, maybe not all your listeners kind of know the sort of steelhead program, but these are spring stocked yearlings. So we're talking 7-8 inch long fish. They're not like a catchable trout. We're not talking numbers of trout that you would put in and immediately go fish for. These are young 1 year old small fish that we're stocking. They're in the river for a week or two and out they go to the lake to grow up. So that's what we're stocking when we talk about these sort of seemingly large numbers.
Yeah. And then how soon will they return then, Kurt, to the Cuyahoga? And I know we get a run now of some fish in the Cuyahoga, just from some spillover from some of the other streams, but how long before these fish, these 60,000 we're stocking, will we be able to see them?
Generically, we'll say 2 years. There's a, like most things in nature, there's kind of a bell curve around everything. Some fish might mature early and come in at a sort of a small size at 1 year, 2 years old, 1 year after stocking. But by and large, they'll be in the lake for 2 years and then they'll make their runs in. So, so we have sort of the summer of 24 and the summer of 25 to wait. We may start seeing them, the fishing season of a little bit of 25, 26, and then certainly fall 26, we'd expect to really see a push of them coming in.
And then how big will they be at that time, generally speaking?
Generally speaking, low 20-inch range.
Okay. That's a nice-sized steelhead for sure.
I'd take it.
Yeah, Don will take it.
Yeah.
So, Kurt, moving to a more general direction, the steelhead is going to be great for us, but what are the general plans for the future of the Cuyahoga? And this can be beyond steelhead. You already touched on the possibility of sturgeon and sawgeye. Anything to wrap up with there?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, as you said, other than the steelhead, I will say, the plan for the steelhead would be just like wash, rinse, repeat. I mean, we'll sort of stock annually at that 60,000 number and see what kind of fishery develops. But yeah, otherwise, it's the lake sturgeon we talked about, and it's really just being at the table with the other partners and doing the things that keep moving the needle to a healthier and an improved Cuyahoga River. So we have a lot of work being done right now with the USGS, the United States Geologic Survey. You would think that's all like rocks, but actually they have a whole sort of biological division that deals with wildlife. And so there's some researchers that are really engaged with some of us state and local partners to do a bunch of fish work in relation to the gorge dam removal and in relation to just fishes kind of recolonizing up the river from, you know, those other dam removals as well. So we'll stay engaged with that. And yeah, just continue to, you know, ODNR as a whole has lots of granting programs like H2 Ohio and the Rivers Program to hopefully keep funneling resources to, you know, land uses and land programs that improve water quality.
Well, man, we sure appreciate your contributions to that, but it kind of shows you what can happen when everybody's rowing in the same direction.
Yeah, that's the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, very good, Kurt. Is there anything else we forgot to mention here that you think of right now?
No? I would just say the listeners that are steelhead anglers, you know, it's a new river, and like you mentioned, they still get some strays that are already coming into the river the last few years, mm-hmm. but you know, in another couple of years, we'll see a good push of fish. And so there'll be a new angler base that fishes those public access points. So, you know, just sort of a charge to the anglers to be good stewards of the land they're on with Metro Parks and National Park Service and, you know, be good users and leave it, you know, as good or better than you found it. So, you know, with all that public access comes lots of management agencies handling and taking care of that public access. So we want to be good anglers and good neighbors.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, I would add, get out and buy that license now. You know, you don't get to catch them for 2 years in a big way, but they had to get stocked now.
That's true.
So buy the license now.
That's true. That's true. Well, very good, Kurt. We wanted to get you on here and get the exactly what was going on there from an authority figure like yourself. And we appreciate everything you guys at the ODNR have done for the steelhead fishery. Really, I think that you've created a monster here in a good way.
Yeah. In a good way.
Yeah.
And, you know, we like to tell the stories that are the stories, and sometimes they're not rosy stories, but this one is really
a good story. Yes.
And we're happy to deliver that. Yeah. So.
Well, thank you again, Kurt. We know you're busy and we appreciate your time here this afternoon.
Yeah, no problem. It's my pleasure and certainly an exciting time for the river.
Yes, it is.
You bet. Thanks, Kurt.
Yeah, and thank you again.
All right, take care.
Thanks for listening to 120 Outdoors and our monthly podcast. Please like, subscribe, and leave us your comments while checking out our Facebook page.